Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. We are in the middle of discussions with a 60-plus panel on Thad Carhart's wonderful memoir, The Piano Shop on the Left Bank. I know one of the programs I said The Piano Shop on the West Bank. That's a different country, so we don't want to say that. But I just wanted, we've been in the middle of discussion about the French as people, and I do have a quote from an interview that Carhart gave to Gavin J. Grant. Now Gavin works with this IndieBound organization. It's really a community of independent booksellers, and they obviously sold this book for Carhart, and then he had an interview with them. And he asked Carhart if he had written the book in French. And here was his answer, and I think it fits in with this whole discussion about the French people. He said, "The subject is a look at France from another perspective, what the French would call the Anglo-Saxon perspective, the Anglo-Saxon world, which is everything that isn't French and is English-speaking." He says, "I could have done it in French, but it just wouldn't have been interesting. They wouldn't have been the same observations. For instance, one of my bilingual French friends read it in English, and she really liked it. But at the end she said, 'And it's something I would have not thought of, but it made perfect sense.' But here's what she said: 'There is entirely too much shaking of hands in this book.'" And I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "It's like saying he took a breath. In France, you just don't walk in and start talking. You shake hands whenever you see someone. It's a different rhythm, a different custom." And so we were talking about the difference between Americans and the French, and that's it. They would have found the book boring because they just assume everybody's going to shake hands. Why do you have to write it down?
Right.
So I know that Derry has you have a thought here. So let's get into this more about the French people.
Yes. Well, you know, the French really value language very much, and they value their language very much. And I think the passport into French culture is really through the language, probably more so in French than in most of the cultures. And you really see that in the book. You know, he's bilingual. He obviously was able to get inside of this French culture and sort of understand the people, because he was accepted as a French speaker, even though he was still considered l'Américain du quartier, an American of the district, you know, that he lived there. But he was considered at least someone that was involved in their culture because he could speak the language very well. So I think that's a key component of becoming a part of that ambiance where you're with the French and sort of knowing what's going on. And then the French, as you say, they do have a different way of dealing with one another. It would be considered terribly forward for you to ask a Frenchman, even a Frenchman that you know well, personal questions. Mm-hmm. Whereas Americans typically feed on that. Americans will ask a lot of personal questions of one another, and that's considered perfectly acceptable and actually part of friendship in the United States. But in France, that would be insulting to ask some very personal questions, and would be very, very awkward, and people would not take to that very, very well. So there's that kind of thing about being careful about what are the themes. You learn about someone else through comments that they make without really having to ask direct questions. It's very sort of an indirect dance around, and that takes time. That takes longer to do than the American method, which is cut through the chase and get to it and ask the questions and get the answer, you know. And the French way is more find out about the history, understand the family connections, and don't ask questions. Let it be told. Let it develop. And that's the way friendships develop. They develop over time. They take time. It's like French cooking. Nothing good can really be done fast. It has to be done slowly.
It has to be done slow. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I know that when Deborah and I took the girls to Paris, I noticed that right away that, of course, Deborah was fluent in French and she could ask directions and she can do that. But it seemed like the people would respond mm-hmm. to that right. because there was an attempt to use the language. And, of course, I might say bonjour or, monsieur, and just I could do little things like that. And they seemed to respond to that and really,
absolutely,
really, really like that. And so I think he learned that. I think on page 120 of the book, it was a big success. I think it was hilarious when the book opens. He walks into this piano shop and the owner says, "What are you doing here?" And he says, "Why, I'm interested in a used piano." He says, "You have to be invited in here."
Right.
And so that's what really got my interest right away in the book. I thought, wow, this is really different. But I thought it was interesting where he's talking about the friendship with Luke. And I think Luke is just a kind of like one of the main characters in the book, even though this is Carhartt's memoir. Luke is like the dominant beam in the whole book. But he says, "As my friendship with Luke grew, I felt more and more at ease at the atelier and found with pleasure that although I was often held affectionately by Luke as l'Américain du quartier, there were times when I became an honorary Frenchman." Mm-hmm. And so they did accept him in. And I think this is the thing we have to understand, that the French are loving people. He said, "Late on Friday afternoons, when Luke had finished up for the day or had concluded a particularly satisfactory transaction at the atelier, would take on the atmosphere of a good cafe. Customers, friends, acquaintances, all would linger for an extra half hour. Luke held forth in the back, sometimes provoking arguments with half-serious assertions and wild claims as a half-dozen conversations motored along the high skylight. He conducted a minor ritual at the end of every Friday, and they would get together and they would, break out a bottle of wine and they would break out the baguettes and have cheese and
right.
and when he talks about wild discussions, that sounds really American, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
it's like if a Frenchman comes to Texas and says, "Oh, you eat those barbecued ribs?" That would be offensive
right.
to a Texan.
Right.
So I think there's all that on both sides. Go ahead, take it away from me.
Well, that is true. That sense of really sharing in the eating and this sort of cafe atmosphere, that really shows that that Carhartt was part of the group, because otherwise he would not have been invited to be part of that. He would have felt like an outsider. And there is a lot of banter going on. The Frenchmen love to talk about politics and various things, so there's always lots of conversation with that. Whenever you're in a cafe or in a conversation, those situations come up. Politics is something that it used to be, I'm not sure about today, but it used to be something you could talk about in France, and everyone could have your own opinion, and your opinion was respected, even though people might not share that opinion. That was the one area that you could talk about, and you could have difference of opinion. That in literature, you could have difference of opinion, and not have enemies, whereas you would not talk about personal things.
So you could talk about that, and it would be interesting.
Right,
it would
right.
be interesting, and you kind of enjoy the fact that someone else believed differently than you, and you would go back and forth with it. But you wouldn't talk about personal things.
Right.
But it was all something that everyone could talk about on the same level,
right.
kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I think it's interesting. We don't have to spend a lot of time with it, but on page 121 and 122, and they talk about the French Masons, the Freemasons,
right.
And of course, there is a lot of tension all over the world, and I know there's tension in France right now.
Hmm.
With it, you have the leftists, you have the far right, you have the Catholic influence, and of course, the Freemasons were really into the République,
uh-huh.
Right. And so I mean, there is a lot, and I just feel I'm actually working on an article for the Trumpet magazine on the dangerous. Personal dissatisfaction with everything right now, and mm-hmm. it's just really very dangerous right. for society. But it seems like even when he was in France and doing all this, it was a different time. You can
yes.
almost
yeah.
it's almost it. Like we're looking Now, this book, it was written in 2000, so it is about 17 years old. But look at how the world has changed in
Absolutely.
17 years.
Mm. Yes.
And so, and let's see, when did we go to France?
It was 1996.
1996. Mm-hmm. So that's a long time ago.
Long time ago.
So yeah,
the first time I went to France.
Our daughters were now 33 and 35, and they were like 10 and 11 then, or whatever.
The first time I went to France was in 1972.
Oh.
And it was like a different world from then even to the 90s.
I was there in 1969.
You were in 69?
Yes.
It was a different world.
Yeah, you may have crossed paths. Yeah. So let's change gears here a little bit. Let's talk about the thing. Again, it's not just piano music, but I really think the book brings out a lot about music as education. And it really does remind me so much of Ryan Malone's program, Music for Life. And it just seems like Carhartt really has a way of capturing that there's life lessons you learn when you learn an instrument.
Absolutely.
And I was really, really quite impressed with that, to the point where, I think I said this on the very first program, that, you know, we inherited my wife's family piano, and it's been, he even brings this out later in the book, and I hadn't finished the whole book when we started the first program, and he brings it out that the piano becomes like the shrine of the family, and it becomes a shrine for art and photographs. Well, unfortunately, our piano is the shrine for photographs.
Yep, family photographs.
And sometimes
yes.
my cufflinks or my watch or my wedding ring or whatever I decide to throw on it. But we decided that's going to change. We're now going to have the piano retuned. It needs a few strings, you know, touched up, and we're going to start tinkering with it. But let's talk about music for education for a little bit. So I know you both have had more lessons than I've had, so I'll let you guys take it away.
Would you like to start?
Okay. Well, reading this book, it made me remember, you know, my experience with piano lessons, and I did not have the same experience he had. I mean, he just loved it, and I didn't have that feeling, and I wish in some ways I had. Part of it, I think, is because I had a teacher who was very boring, and I'm not going to blame
Hopefully
it on her.
Hopefully she's dead by
now. Yes, I'm not going to blame it on her, but it was never an exciting event. And I liked the piano. I loved music. My mother played the piano. She sang hymns. To me, having a piano in the home is important, and so I always loved music. I really liked the piano because I learned where the notes were for singing in choirs, which I've always enjoyed doing the most. But him talking about the different kinds of teachers, I can see there. You know, a teacher really is important in the kind of in terms of the reason why you're learning to play the piano. And different children and different students need a different kind of a teacher. You know, some are better for a student, more better than others. Then actually, when I was older, I was in my early 20s, I had a friend who was teaching piano lessons, and she I took lessons from her for a little while, and I actually started to enjoy it for a little while. And I thought, oh, maybe I could do this, but I didn't keep up with it. So I've appreciated knowing.
It's because you met me.
Yes, that's right. That was about the same time. That's right. So anyway, that was my experience. But it was interesting hearing him talk about the and maybe you will talk about that, Derry, about the different teachers and especially the one teacher who made the pressure of performing.
Right, yes. Right. Yeah. I thought that was what was so appealing about this book, is he talked about his teachers and how he would have good teachers, and then he would have bad teachers, and the influence, both positive and negative, they have. And that was my own background. Mm-hmm. I started taking piano lessons when I was 5 years old, and I took it on a parlor grand piano in a big old Southern home. And I had those images in my mind of learning piano like that. Then when I became older, 8 or 9 years old, I switched to violin. And so then from then on, I took lessons with violin. But you would have one violin teacher who would be maybe very good and show you something. And the next violin teacher would be someone that would just wrap your fingers and yell at you and all those kinds and scold you. And you'd start to hate it.
Like Catholic school.
Right. And then you would switch to someone else. So there's this litany of one good teacher juxtaposed with a bad teacher and all those kinds of experiences they give you. And all the way through it, and he talks about Miss Pemberton, who was one of his teachers, and said that music is to share. So you have to have a recital, and you have to be able to play for others. And And he rebels against that. He says that music is something that you should enjoy on your own. You don't have to perform for others. You don't have to be a concert pianist to do that. And it's just music for the sake of music and the beauty and the education that it brings to one's individual self, which I think is wonderful, because anyone that's taken music for a long time, you always feel this this need to perform, that you really should be performing for others, you know, doing that kind of thing. But the greatest joy in it is just really the music itself, learning the music, learning all the things about it, to enjoy it yourself or with people that you want to share it with, not necessarily have to share it with a large group. Mm-hmm. And sometimes a large group would not appreciate what you have to share in many cases. Yeah. When you're out of practice, at least.
If we have time, we can talk about the Fazoli and,
oh, yes.
And how
right.
how he went to see this exquisite piano that's like worth $100 million, mm-hmm. and he was invited to play on it.
Right,
and he
right.
did.
Right.
I do think that Thad Carhart is probably a better pianist. Than,
oh, I'm sure.
Than he lets pianist. On. If yeah. you Mm-hmm. If you just look at all the discussion of all the different pieces right. he seemed to know.
Right.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah.
You know, you get the feeling that you know, he probably did know, you know, a lot more. Just to remind everybody out there listening in is, if you remember the programs from we did with Ryan Malone, is he, if you really want to take French, not French lessons, you can take, you can get French lessons online. but if you really want to take good, you know, good piano lessons, if you write to him, you know, and you can even write to kpcg.fm if you need to, he would help you find the right lessons for you as an adult or even for you as a child or your child. And, you know, he would really, you know, really be able to help you with that. I know in the book, I think it was very interesting. It's so important for a child to get the right teacher. And I know our daughters are all very musical and, you know, they've played different instruments. And I know our youngest daughter played violin. You know, our daughter, our third daughter played piano, but the two older ones were in a jazz band for years at the high school, and they had a great teacher. I don't remember what the teacher's name was, but I remember going to their concerts, and it was just so much fun. She was kind of small at the time. Our second daughter played the Barry sax, which is like almost as big as she was, but they did really good with that. And they also learned, I think my oldest daughter has such a beautiful voice, but I think she learned singing from that as well. She would sing with the jazz band, and so I thought it was interesting. And I don't know if you haven't read to the end of the book yet, is Thad Carhart believes jazz pianists are some of the most talented pianists alive mm-hmm. today, mm-hmm. and he said even Beethoven would be impressed with some right. of what they do right. on a jazz piano. Now, mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily into all jazz. Some jazz I really like, the more of the easy listening, the scooping and stuff like that. I'm not really into that because I really feel like it's a little, well, maybe I shouldn't say that, but anyway, I'm into high culture, let's put it that way. I'd rather hear Andre Watts
right.
beat on our Steinway.
Well, he's talking about in terms of the improvisation, I think, and what they can do
right,
with you know, they use the structure of music, and but yet they can do really interesting things with it.
And that is unique.
That's unique.
Very,
yes.
All
that
innovation
yes,
is very
that,
unique.
That's what we're talking about.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing is, I think before we came in here today, I know mm-hmm. we were all talking about this book. I think it's good for any lessons that you're into, even if it's yes. if it's something as simple as sewing. Or if it's art, I think I've mentioned I'm taking this art course from the University of Washington in Washington State, and he basically this it's the I think his name is David Brody, and he says the same thing. Once you learn the fundamentals, I mean, there's they start you, and he doesn't care where you are as an artist. He starts you back at the fundamentals, and it's like painful, you know, going back, and you just have to draw circles, and you have to draw squares, and you have to draw rectangles, and you have to draw, you know, then you split them apart, you know, and they become, you know, diamonds and, you know, things like that. But then he says, once you get that down and you really see the geometric structures, then you improvise. Mm-hmm. Then you improvise. Mm-hmm. And so I think all art, whether it's music or it's drawing, whether it's dancing, you have to learn those fundamental skills. And then you can improvise. And that's the way it is with life, too. There are certain fundamental laws that you need to know and obey to be successful in life. And, of course, we know what those laws are. It's the Ten Commandments. And if you have that down and you follow those and you're really obedient to those, your success is pretty much guaranteed. But if you don't follow those, well, life falls apart. And the thing is when I look at Thad Carhart's life, you know, unless he just hides it, well, he's a family man. He has two children. His wife is a famous Italian photographer. So it seemed like they have this family life together, and the piano was a part of that. Right. You know, his daughter, you know, they made sure she got the right lessons. And, you know, study that those when you get into the book, look at pages 170 through 174 on the Schola Cantorum. And that's where even these people in this school realized, well, you don't make music against someone else. It's not a competition. It's for your own education. And if you discipline yourself and if you learn those basics and then you use those basics and you produce beautiful music, you'll have peace in your life and you'll be successful in other areas. I think it's fantastic.
I think a lot of the things that Anna, who is his last piano teacher, says to him are words of wisdom that are good for anyone in any field, because she says to him that one of the things as he's practicing and working, she says, être patient avec soi-même, which means that you must be patient with yourself. And that's so true in so many areas of life. She also says, travailler par petits bouts, which means work in small pieces. So you have to work in small pieces. You have to certainly be patient with yourself. And then she says, pas d'accent. Don't overemphasize some things. You know, some things, put them in their proper perspective. So, and those are points that come across in piano instruction, but they also come across as lessons of life that are important in life in general.
Right. And I think no matter what you do, I think, you know, I love writing. I love my job as a writer. Of course, I love doing this program as well. I love teaching literature. But you do have to work from small. And in fact, there's one book I've read not too long ago where it's called Write Small. If you can't write small, you can't write big. You know, you have to learn to put all the structure, and there's grammatical structure you have to learn as well. So, but it's the same way with your children. You have to work with them, start working with them when they're small, and you do small things, and you just keep building on it. And again, I hope Helen McDonald reads this book.
I hope she would like it.
Yeah, I hope she would like it. So that's not to pick on you, Miss McDonald, if you're listening in. Anyway. I think if we could we have a few minutes left here. Could we just talk a little bit about the writing of the book?
Yes.
Yeah. I just think from a writer myself, this is the kind of book you dream you could write. I mean, it's just an amazing book. So, Deborah, I'll let you talk about this.
Well, I really did, like I said, memories. I remember the one place where he talks about walking down the streets, after taking his children to school, he would often take extra 10 minutes to retrace my steps, savoring the sense of promise and early morning calm that at this hour envelops Paris. And I, you know, early morning is great in a city. And then he talks about the smell from La Boulangerie du Coin, the local bakery, always greeted me as I turned the corner. The essence of freshly baked bread, never failing to fill me with desire and expectation. And that I remember that. We used to get up and early and get on the train, and there was always a boulangerie with where we'd buy some bread or something, or baguette or brioche or something. And so those memories are great. And then also I liked when he talks about...
Do you have a page number there for us?
Okay, page 11 is where he finally figures out he has to have a reference in order to be able to actually go into the shop and actually ask for a piano. And it says, I just think it's so funny, he says, after he left his children off, he said, no morning daydreams, down the narrow street, no leisurely walk home. I felt like a character in a fairy tale. who has performed the difficult task and has returned to the palace to claim his reward. So I thought that was pretty funny. So he finally figured out it was kind of like this, you know, this fairy tale or like a mystery. Okay, and he was on his way to claim it. So I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think his descriptions of the buildings and everything in Paris are beautiful. In page 174, this is that getting back to that Schola Cantorum. He's waiting to be able to talk to the instructors because he wants. I think it's interesting. His son wanted to play the. It just escaped my mind. The recorder. And his daughter wanted to play the piano, but he says, "I sat in the garden looking back at the Schola through the trees. The main wing was made of light yellow stone that is so common for French architecture of the 18th century, with full-length windows on each floor set into the stone, a slate mansard roof, delicate wrought iron balustrades at the windows, and simple detailing on the upper stories completed the vision of a domain belonging to the Enlightenment. What had this same pavilion looked like as a prison during the Revolution? It wasn't hard to imagine that this quiet inner courtyard had witnessed scenes of unmentionable dismay and despair in the convulsion of fervor that was concentrated in Paris." He says, "I consider this place as secret in its way as Luke's atelier. It seemed to embrace the past without being lost in it. It was old, but not in the least stuffy, and I reflected that the same friend who had labeled it dusty had referred to it to the sad premises. I found them anything but sad. Dilapidated, yes, but exhibiting the kind of shabby gentility that was expected with an old mansion." That's just great. That's just great writing, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes. Yeah.
So,
I think too he captures moments in a way that are very poignant, and generally his writing is very unobtrusive. I mean, it just flows. Everything flows very nicely. You don't seem to get bogged down with anything. But there is a section where he talks about one of his teachers that he had, and her name is Miss. It really wasn't a teacher. It was an encounter that he had with someone by the name of Miss Killian, who was a very perceptive older woman, and she heard him playing one day, and he didn't realize that anyone was listening, and so she came to the door to while he was playing and said something. And let me just, this is on page 90, but I'll just read this. He says, "Sarah," that's his sister, "never told me that she had a brother who was a pianist. Well, if you're like me," this is of course Miss Killian speaking, "well, if you're like me, you prefer to be left alone when you play. Let me close both the doors so you won't be disturbed." And then Carhartt writes, It was as if she had read my mind, had looked right inside and seen specific instructions under the heading, "What This Boy Wants," and was following them. As she turned to leave, she looked back and said, "It's a wonderful piano, isn't it?" "Yes, ma'am, it is. It's wonderful." So it's a very little encounter like that, but it's like he captured how this was such a precious moment for him, that an adult actually understood what he was thinking and said the very words that he wanted to hear at that moment.
Yeah. The book is great. We are out of time for today. We'll probably go ahead and I'll have one last program on this book because we just can't get away from it. But remember now that we are going to be reading Country Driving, A Chinese Road Trip by Peter Hessler. And so, again, please come to China with us. And the 60 Plus panel will be there right with me. So, again, I would very much like to hear what you have to say about the piano shop on the left bank. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1, and you can also follow JBL on Facebook. That address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.